to make a transmission right now to check out his equipment. K2 Uniform Papa Sierra Mobile. K2 RIW in the TechNet. You've got it, Rich.
Okay, K2 UPS Mobile, Pennsylvania now. I'm hearing you fine through the, you know, the H5 machine. When you switched over and you started transmitting, I guess, through the 375, your audio dropped by, I'd say, close to half. And Eric's audio, what I'm hearing him coming in, is about what I heard you on coming through 375. But I'm hearing you fine here. The audio is plenty loud for me on this end.
Fantastic, Rich. That last transmission was the best you ever made. Nice, clean audio, perfect volume. I cranked it up. Okay, so all of those changes were what Eric did. I thought you did something out there, Rich. So, Erica, looks like you've made the audio from Rich to this machine. Fantastic. Well done. You get the star for the day. KE2EJ, K2LAW. Go ahead, Eric.
The reason why the audio is so bad coming the other way right now is because Singo is limited. I've got to go out there. The other link that I used to have, if you notice, this link makes it clean sounding. No pop noises or anything like that. And when I see it, I'll tell you about it. So the previous unit, which had the VCO that I built, needed a bit more audio drive, and I'm going to have to turn it down.
Okay, we're making progress. What Eric is mentioning is that for the last 6 months or so, the particular radio link he was using between the Eastern machine out in Selden, Long Island, and the Western machine in Glen Oaks at the Nassau-Suffolk County border, that radio link was picking up some extraneous bursts of noise that was local to where those repeaters are located. So it looks like he's changed the frequency, he's changed the band, he's changed something on the radio link, and I'm seeing great improvement, so keep doing it. Whatever you're doing, Eric, keep doing more of it. Reminds me of my process of tuning 915 megacycle antennas on a small antenna range on the top of a bench using a vector network analyzer. As you wave a tool near the elements of the antenna, you see improvement. And it gets better. You say, keep doing that because you're watching what happens in real time. So give me a description now, Joe. Tell me the schematic diagram you've used. What's the source of voltage? Was it 60 hertz? How did you put that voltage through the inductor and then into your sensing equipment? So tell me that schematic diagram. Tell me what you calculated as to the inductor reactance. Tell me what voltage you expected to see. Tell me what you saw. And what made you think that?
Okay, I need to break you for a second.
Go ahead, Eric.
I'm going to get to my face on the computer here.
This is Victor Echo 7, Lima Tango Delta testing. VE7LTD, testing 123. This is Victor Echo 7, Lima Tango Delta with an audio test. Audio test 123, VE7LTD.
K2EJ, K2RIW.
some guy complain and make fun of you, it's not going to be about that. It'll be about something else.
And you're going to complain about the way I treat all my women. Okay. And looks like you and I are going to have a private conversation on some particular subject. Not good for over the air. So, give me the schematic diagram, Joe, as to how you're testing inductors. They are a bit more complicated than capacitors. Capacitors are very easy to test. And if I go down the list of all the reasonably sharp radio amateurs I know with an engineering background, with or without an engineering background, and I say, you've got nothing but a 6.3 volt filament transformer, a source of 110 volts going into the primary. You've got some unknown picofarad rated size capacitors, and you've got a digital voltmeter with an AC scale. If I give that problem to all the hams I know, I would be amazed if 5% of them could give me a fast answer. Some of them could eventually figure it out, but such a simple circuit making such a valuable measurement, particularly in view of the fact that not everybody owns an RLC meter, it's discouraging that so few people know how to do that, and an extremely small group of people would be able to measure an inductor. So let's find out how you are measuring inductors, Joe. Debate YYY. Not good subject. We all need to know this very basic information. This is the foundation. K2RAW. You got it, Joe.
Delta, British Columbia. British Columbia.
Are you doing a further test, Eric? Should we stand by? KE2EJ, KJRIW, or should I continue?
No, I'm just closing things up.
Very fine. Joe, you got the floor. W2RYY, KJRIW, and the deck net.
Okay, I wasn't using your testing method. I was using a different testing method. And I didn't come out with the right calculations for the inductor, but I did for the capacitor.
Okay, can you give us a little bit of a description of how you measured inductors? You came to us saying that you measured inductors and you got answers that are not making sense, but you've given us no further information. It's like the problem my son has when he was working for the IT department of a particular company. And a client would say, I need service on my desktop computer at my workstation. And my son would ask, what's the problem? And the guy would answer, it ain't working. Can you give me another hint? The K2RYY, K2RIW.
Why, sure. I can give you a hint. I can even give you the exact information I recorded down as I made measurements. How's that? Now, you might be able to actually sit through your GI calculator and calculate out what I did to see if it's actually right or actually wrong. Would you really like that information? I'll give it to you right now. First of all, I used a 100-volt source out of a variac transformer because I wanted to use a higher voltage to be able to get higher reading and higher accuracy. So I used my variac and set the variac output. So I got 100.0 volts. I was a little tough to keep it exactly 100.0 because your line voltage goes up and down slightly. And that was a bit of a challenge, making sure that I would have my 100-volt source out of variac for easy calculations. Next thing you used was a 100K resistor, 5% rating, and its actual ohmic value that I measured with my Fluke BOM was 98.6K. Okay, so now you have those two numbers there. Let's see. I took R1 and put it in series with L1. And the voltage I measured across R1 was, the first thing we showed for the test was 99.4 volts. And the voltage I measured across L1 was 3.20 volts. Alright. Now, if I calculate, let's see, page here. Okay. The current in the circuit, looking at it from what's going across R1, 0.00100811 amps. And that leads the reactants of the choke, supposedly according to the form, according to the calculation, with the voltage drop across the choke, it leads you to believe that the choke has a reactance of 3174.2 ohms. But the choke's rating is supposed to be a 5 Henry choke. That's what I'm saying. It doesn't come out correctly. Either I'm doing something wrong, my measurement is not working correctly. When I measured some capacitors, and I'll give you those in a moment here, let's see, using the same resistor, same voltage source, the caps happen to be 0.003 microfarad, and with one cap in series of one resistor, R1's voltage drop was 10.6. C1's voltage drop was 98.1. And I said, okay, let me see what's putting out the caps in there in parallel with the first cap, what that does to the whole formula here. I put two caps in parallel, and I get 21.4 volts across R1. C2's voltage drop is 95.5. I tried three caps across, and the R1 voltage drop is 30.6. And the voltage drop across C1 is 92.5. I tried four caps, and voltage drop across R1 goes to 39.8, and voltage drop across C1 is 88.7. So I calculate those backwards with the formula, and I do know the formula because I have an extra class license like you, and it come out pretty much correctly as far as the value of the caps. But the inductor is what the question is. It doesn't come out correctly.
Okay. You believe you were testing a 5 Henry inductor, and the inductor reactance is 2 pi FL. 2 pi is a 6.28, F is 60 Hertz, and L is 5 Henry. You multiply those together, and the calculated inductive reactance at 60 Hertz of a 5 Henry inductor should be 1.8 kilo-ohms, 1804. Round it off, I plugged in 6.28 as opposed to really 2 pi, so 1.8 kilo-ohms. The current flowing through your 100K resistor, which was very close to 100 volts of drop, was 99.4, but I'm rounding numbers off here just to get into the ballpark. And by the way, as I see it, back of the envelope, ballpark calculations at times like this are extremely valuable, where you round off the numbers just to find out, is it fish or fowl? Are we talking about a milliamp or 5 amps, so to speak? Let me drop. So in your case, you have just a little bit shy of 100 volts across the 100K resistor. By definition, the current flowing through the resistor is very close to 1 milliampere, just a skosh under 1 milliampere. 1 milliampere flowing into an inductor, which has an inductive reactance calculation of 1.8 kilo-ohms, would be lots of voltage. Let me drop here now and see. Yeah, there's the voltage, and 1 milliamp, 1 exponential 3 change sign. There's the current. Therefore, I should have had a voltage drop of around 1.8 volts. You measured 3.2 volts on that 5 Henry inductor. That's in the right ballpark. In other words, your inductor of 5 Henry is giving you twice the voltage drop of the calculation, roughly. 1.8 volts is what I would have calculated, rough numbers. 3.2 is what you saw. Therefore, the ratio of what you saw, what you expected, is 1.69. Multiply that times 5 Henrys, I get 8.4 Henrys. In other words, my calculation with the raw numbers you've given me, Joe, let me drop. Your 5 Henry inductor, by the numbers you've just given me, rough numbers, I'm not using the fine details here, is around 8.4 Henry, is what I calculate for your inductor, 8.49. Is that reasonable? Absolutely. Because when a manufacturer manufactures an inductor, he knows a 5 Henry inductor is going to go into a power supply where the power supply is going to be drawing 100 milliamps, 500 milliamps, maybe an amp, at some significant amount of current is going to flow through that inductor when it's really being used. Nobody uses a 5 Henry inductor to make an audio oscillator. He's going going to be using it in a power supply, and current is going to flow through that inductor in the operation of the Pi filtering network of that power supply. Let me drop. And the manufacturer knew that every real inductor with a magnetic core, in order to get some reasonable number of turns of winding, in order to get a reasonable amount of Henry's of inductance, he's got a magnetic core there. He's got EI laminations or the equivalent in there somewhere. As such, when DC current flows through that inductor and the magnetic core partially saturates, in other words, saturate means that anything above 50 milliamps flowing through that inductor is going to start the saturation process. And when an inductor starts saturating, the number of Henry starts coming down. So this conservative manufacturer of that inductor knows that he wants 5 Henry's of inductance under real working conditions. Maybe that inductor is rated for a quarter of an ampere. So when a quarter of an ampere of average DC current is flowing through it, when the power supply is doing its thing, your 8 Henry's is going to come down to 5.5 Henry's, so to speak. So you've got a very reasonable set of numbers there. From my point of view, Joe, do you see where I'm going on this one? And should I run that by one more time? I think you've got a very reasonable measurement on that 5 Henry inductor. 8 Henry's is darn good. That's a conservative manufacturer. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I don't see where you're going with this, because the rating is a lot higher than what the book says. The book says on that particular part, its rating is 5 Henry's, 80 ohms, 400 mils. Okay, if he is already in it, then that could be, but he did the same thing with another inductor. I'll give an example of another one. And you can back check about the current, unless you want me to give it to you exactly, but let's see. I use a different inductor that's rated at, is stating at 3 Henry's, 30 ohms DC resistance. And that's the use with less current, like 250 mils, 300 mils current rating. That had 99.6 across R1, and across L1, I got 1.64 volts. That's supposed to be a good inductor. And that calculation does come out right here. It's like, it's different than when I'm getting it. The whole purpose of me doing all this, first the capacitor, because I had a bag of capacitors that were unknowns, and now I found out I know what the value is. Okay, so that's great. The whole purpose of measuring these chokes is this goes back to a problem I had with a high voltage power supply that's used on equipment that's made about at least 45 years ago. And I had a bad part of the power supply give me a substantial voltage drop, which caused the thing not to work correctly. And it turned out to be a bad reactor choke on the high voltage side. So I took some good ones and one bad one, and I tried to put them into this kind of circuit and make some measurements to see, okay, does the spotlight shine on the bad choke? And apparently it doesn't, because my readings are far off of what I expected them to be.
E2IS query.
Bill, we're going to get you in a second. Let Joe continue. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, so even the 3 Henry choke doesn't come up to the right rating. It seemed like the inductance is much different. You want to calculate the cell, like I said, R1 with 99.6. Volts drop across L1, changing the choke to a 3 Henry choke with 1.64 volts. Same 100.0 volts applied. Doesn't calculate out right. I was trying to spot the bad one. And then I tried other chokes there, and I got voltage drops across other chokes like 2.14 volts. And 2.00 volts, and with the R1 value going up slightly, a couple of tenths of a volt, like I went down 99.4 on the second test, 99.6 on the third test, but the value of the voltage across the L1 went up and down a little bit. I was just trying to basically determine which choke was apparently bad, and I can't seem to really do that because they all give me ratings that are out of the ballpark. They're not close to what I'm supposed to, I would expect as far as the manufacturer's specifications. And I do realize, man, this is being used in a bridge circuit, too. So I do realize 120 volts of ripple, 120 cycles of ripple applied to this choke. So maybe they did this purposely. And the rating's actually different what the book says. I don't know, but apparently it's a substantial difference. You're saying it calculates out like like I think calculated out the same thing. The inductance apparently calculates out to something much higher than what the book says the part's supposed to be.
We're going to go over to Bill in a minute. You've got two good inductors there, in my opinion, Joe. Your first inductor, by my calculations, which is supposed to be 5 Henry, measured 8.4 Henry. That's not out of the ballpark. That's exactly where it should be when there's no DC current flowing through it. There's your inductor that was that's marked 3 Henry by the numbers you've just given me, measures 4.35 Henry. So your 5 Henry choke measured 8 Henry. Your 3 Henry choke measured 4.3 Henrys. In both cases, you're measuring them with no DC current flowing through them. By the normal operations of an EI lamination core, by which you make a 60-cycle transformer or a 60-cycle choke or inductor, it's intended for a full-wave or a half-wave power supply, where it's going to be seeing ripple of either 60 hertz or 120 hertz. That's the way you build that kind of an inductor. I guarantee if you took that thing apart, you ain't going to find ferrite in there. You're going to find EI laminations. That's the cheapest way to do it. But EI laminations have got this crazy saturation characteristic. When DC current flows through that, in one case, a 80-ohm resistance coil. And by the way, one of your inductors is rated for 400 milliamps of current. The other is rated for 300 milliamps. If you measured them with simultaneous 400 milliamps and 300 milliamps of DC current flowing through the inductor, at the exact same time you're injecting an AC signal and measuring the AC reactance, guaranteeing your 5 Henry inductor, instead of measuring 8 Henry, is going to measure 5.5 Henry. Your 3 Henry inductor, which right now, with no current, is measuring 4.3 Henry, it's going to come down to 3.2 Henry. You think these readings are out of the ballpark? Let me drop this. In the case of a small capacitor that's in the vicinity of, let me pick a number, 5 picofarads up to 5,000 picofarads, disc ceramic capacitors and dog bone capacitors, you're going to find they're very close to the right value, because the nice thing about capacitors is that as you put DC voltage on them, the apparent capacitance, with rare cases, does not change. And therefore, if you're using that capacitor for doing bypassing operation, you'd like it to have at least that many picofarads or microfarads or larger, and you'd be happy, and you'd get a good bypassing operation. In the case of a dog bone type resonating picofarad capacitor, you're using it usually in a resonating circuit, and you'd like the reactants, the capacitive reactants, to be pretty accurate, so that you're in the right ballpark of the resonant frequency of that circuit. But in the case of inductors intended for 60-cycle power supply operation, to make the Henrys under no DC current measure higher is exactly right. You're not only in the ballpark, you're halfway between the pitcher's mound and the home plate, if you know what I mean. These values you've measured on your inductor, in my opinion, are right on the money, Joseph. And so you and I are going to have to discuss this a little bit more, but I think you've got good inductors. Before I go back over to Bill, let me send it back to you for a little rebuttal on this. Do you see where I'm going with this? The B2RYY, good set of questions. K2IW, the TechNet.
Okay, the first inductor with that 3.2 volt drop across the inductor, that's supposed to be a bad one, and I pulled that out of a power supply, which, when I changed from another scrap power supply, just changing that inductor, it made the voltage output under load, under DC load, go up substantially, and I was able to obtain my 670, 680 volt DC supply to the final to the transmitter to make the right output. That's where this all came from. I don't remember, I asked you about this question about probably about a year or two ago, but it's been stale for a while because I just was playing with other things. So I took another choke, a good one, and it measures 3.85 across the inductor. Another good choke measures 3.52 across the inductor. So they're a little higher, but not by too much. I guess the ultimate question I'm asking is, if I'm using the wrong type of circuit to test these things, without having an RLC meter where I can measure the Q of the circuit, under test, the inductance and so forth, how do you determine if you have a bad inductor that you know it doesn't work in the intended circuit, but you have it sitting in front of you compared to a good part? How do you tell one from the other? What made it go bad? What happened to it?
I do remember this episode of about a year and a half or 2 years ago, where on a number of the technets, you were telling us about this power supply giving you the wrong voltage. You wanted something like 680 volts, and you were getting something very different, as I remember. It's one of these rack-mounted type power supplies that was running some radio equipment, transmitting radio equipment. And you had this mysterious inductor that when you substituted it, finally, improvement took place. And that now that's the very inductor that you just measured. It's supposed to be 5 Henry, and we measured 8.4 Henry. The fact that the inductor in this test, in my opinion, is measuring good is a necessary but not sufficient set of tests. Under the real power supply, under real load, where that inductor is rated for 400 milliamps, and maybe your power supply loads it to 350, there's a zillion ways that an inductor in your particular circuit will measure good, necessary but not sufficient, but not necessarily be good enough for the real working conditions. The real working conditions, the inductor is seeing, oh, I'm going to pick a number, 300 volts of AC ripple peak to peak, which it's smoothing, and 350 milliamps of current. Under those conditions, that particular inductor, which had a mysterious failure, obvious by how difficult it was to troubleshoot that power supply and finally find out who the bad guy was. Let me drop this. You're about to hear me ask, what can an inductor do under real working conditions that makes a change so much from these conditions that you just measured? The conditions that you measured are a beautiful way for measuring the approximate value of the inductance, but you're measuring it under very small ripple characteristics with no DC current. Therefore, you're going to get significantly different readings. Your 5 Henry inductor, if I had to speculate what's going on, your 5 Henry inductor, when 350 milliamps is flowing through it, maybe it saturates a lot faster because the iron in there was the wrong iron. In other words, the guy got a shipment of iron that's really bad stuff that saturates much too easily. It's got very low mu. In other words, inductance per cubic inch or per cubic centimeter of iron. It's got lousy iron, and or it might have a shorted turn, a partially shorting turn, turns that arc over when 350 volts of ripple is put on the inductor, and you're only putting 3 volts of ripple on it. So your test, as I said, is necessary but not sufficient. It says that so far it's good, but it's going to be a lot more elaborate test to put real peak-to-peak voltage of the right waveform and real current through it to find out what was the method of failure. Right now, if I had to make a guess, you've either got lousy iron in that 5 Henry inductor, or it's got turns that arc over under real working conditions with higher voltage ripple across it than you tested. Right now, the inductor is measuring good, but measuring inductors under real working conditions is a whole art and science. As you can tell, you're into a very interesting area of investigation here, Joe. Right now, it appears to be a mystery, and I've made some speculations as to what the motive of the failure could be, assuming this is really the bad inductor. Let's see what Bill's got to ask on all of this. EC2IS, I wonder if you run into anything like this one, Bill. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Repeater, timeout.
Yes, and, I'm not sure I'm following this entire problem, but I do have something kind of similar. Recently wound I think it's a 6-turn inductor around a 1/4-inch screw. You take it off, and it's supposed to be a 0.1 microhenry. Trying to find a way to measure that to confirm it. I don't think there's any reason it would not be the described value, but just curious as to how I could measure something that small when most LCR meters seem to not go that low. AC2IS.
6DPZ with a comment.
Let's see how Hal was doing this. How would you measure 6 microhenries of homebrew inductor? K6DPZ, K2RIW.
Okay, first of all, you have an RF signal generator. That's number one. And you have a scope. Tell me what instruments you have, and I'll tell you how you're doing.
You've got it, Bill.
I do not have a function generator, but maybe I could build something. And for an oscilloscope, I've got really old rig that probably takes 15 minutes to warm up, and I have a new thing that's very handheld, but probably, I don't know, in idle. Voltage reading I could get off of AC2IS.
It looks like you'd be pretty shy on test equipment there, Bill. However, you have access to a beautiful laboratory where you can get your hands on better test equipment. Assuming he's got the oscilloscope that you'd like him to have, Hal, and assuming he's got access to either a audio or RF signal generator, let's see how you would proceed. K6DPZ, K2RAW.
Okay, the one instrument that he had would do the whole thing without a scope or a signal generator. Do you have, by chance, that little instrument that always winds up staying in the flea market and nobody grabs, a grid dip meter?
AC2IS here. I think you said cricket meter. Is that correct? That's not sounding familiar to me. AC2IS.
A grid dip meter. They're always sitting at a ham fest on the corner table. Everybody passes them by. They're gold in the box.
Dick, could you relay that word to me? I'm G-R-I, grid get meter, AC2IS.
He's saying grid dip meter, G-R-I-D, that's the grid dip, D-I-P meter. Heathkit made a very nice one. General Radio made an extremely nice one. That meter has got a coil sticking out of the top. You hold that coil near a circuit that you want to find out the resonant frequency. You turn the dial in the front of this thing, which is marked in megahertz, depending on which coil is plugged in, and you look at the indicator on the meter movement that's sitting on the table that's connected to it with a wire, and as you turn the dial on the thing in your hand, and as that coil with its oscillator inside is oscillating at the various frequencies, when the coil sticking out of the top of the meter hits the resonant frequency, and you're holding it near your circuit that is resonant at that frequency, it'll suck out some of the power. That's the power of resonance. The meter indicating the magnitude of the voltage of the oscillation, the meter will go down. That's the so-called grid dip. And when you get to the bottom of that dip, you then read, and then you back off a little bit to make sure you're lightly loading the circuit, and you read the frequency off that dial. And these machines go, the cheap ones go up to 150 megahertz and down to a fraction of a megahertz when you plug in the right coils. The expensive ones go up to 950 megahertz, the general radio one. So as a very simple testing tool, it is the combination, let me drop this. You could say it is the combination of a signal generator and a amplitude indicator. Reasonable accuracy on the signal generating function. You can also use it as a poor man's signal generator. You hold your grid dip meter near the twin lead of your television aerial in the old days, and you could create beat notes on the television screen back in the days we had analog television. So it's a very handy, very broad range, very inexpensive signal generator with indicator. That grid dip meter, Hal is strongly recommending any of you guys with the sound of his voice. Go to a flea market, and if somebody is selling one of those, no matter how ratty it looks, if you think you can make it work, buy it. If you don't own any other test equipment, you're going to get more bang per dollar in test equipment with that thing than most other things you can buy. I think that's approximately what you're saying, Hal. I'm putting words in your mouth. K6DPZ, a grid dip meter lower. K2RAW in the TechNet. You got it, Hal.
K2RAW in TechNet. K6DPZ. Rich, Dick, you gave a very good explanation. Took words out of my mouth. That's all you have to do is find yourself a grid dip meter, because there's, as I said, the poor little toy that everybody passes by, and it's gold in the box. And what you do, you put a capacitor across that choke, take the grid dip meter, and you're going to find, let's say you put, 50 puffs, 50 or 100 puff capacitor across that unknown choke. You couple the choke near the grid dip meter, At a point, you're going to see resonance. Read the frequency of the grid dim meter, and if you know the known value of the capacitor, you can figure out the inductance. Go right to the handbook, and you got all your answers made. Go ahead.
Yeah, you can go to the radio amateur's handbook, and you look at the chart on reactance, and you look at the line, a 45-degree line for 50 picofarad, in Hal's example, and you look at the horizontal axis for frequency of resonance, and where the two lines cross, you say, aha, that's 6 microhenries, if you know what I mean. That's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is you know that the resonance of a circuit is 1 over 2 pi square root of LC. So you know the C, in his example, 50 picofarad, you know the frequency, that's what you measured on the grid dip meter, and you plug in the known values, you solve for the unknown value, and you're going to be measuring inductance directly. So you can do it as a handheld calculator calculation, or even on pencil and paper if you had to. And so that grid dip meter, in some respects, is a poor man's vector network analyzer, because it is a combination of signal generator with amplitude indicator, and so it couples very nicely to the air. You can test your receivers with it. You can test capacitors and inductors with it, and so you get a lot of bang for the money, and grid dip meters at flea markets sometimes sell for extremely cheap prices because people don't know what they are. No school gives you instruction. Let me drop. No modern-day college in electrical engineering gives you any instruction on the use or theory of operation of a grid dip meter. They're missing a huge, important opportunity by avoiding that valuable piece of information. We amateurs are smart enough to tell each other this well-kept secret about what that damn thing can do, how cheap it is, how valuable it is as a test tool, in the hands of a guy that's a little bit crafty. I mean, it's the equivalent of using toothpicks and straws and glue and making yourself a scale and measuring the weights of objects to the nearest milligram, if you know what I mean. If you're crafty enough, you can do that. This falls into that category. So, but by way of the laboratory you have access to, Bill, you have all kinds of ways of measuring that inductor in your case. Let me give you one of a warning, though. Let me drop. When you wind a number of turns of wire on a screw, and if the screw is being used as a coil form, and then after you've wound the wire, you remove the screw, and now you have a known number of turns of coil with a known diameter of the coils and known spacing of the coils. And by the way, you go to the radio amateur's handbook and you plug in those numbers of diameter, spacing, and number of turns, and it'll tell you microhenry. So in air, an air core coil of X number of turns is very calculatable to the nearest 5 or 10% accuracy, if you know what I mean. Error, 95% accuracy you can get out of that. If you leave the screw inside of this air core, the screw is not ferrite material. It's material with a huge amount of, what's the word for it, lost tangent is way of putting it. That steel screw is not made to operate at radio frequency, so it's going to give you a hugely lower inductance because of the crazy characteristics of the screw, which was not designed to be the core of a radio frequency circuit. AC2IS, K2IW, go ahead, Bill.
This is AC2IS. So I had assumed that the screw being a conductor would just short, you know, end up being a short. You would not have an inductor at all. So instead of using a steel screw, what I used was a nylon screw, and I'm not sure how much that's going to affect things, but I figured it would at least keep the inductor from being crushed if it were touched or impacted in any way. AC2IS.
35, Bill. Now you're giving us a lot more of the picture. I assumed you were using enamel-covered wire. That's what an awful lot of people use when they wind an air core coil, and you had wound it onto a metallic screw. You're very smart to use any kind of wire, with or without enamel covering, on a nylon screw. And at most RF frequencies, the presence of the nylon screw would be a secondary effect. The capacitive reactance of the nylon, the, what's the word for it now, dielectric constant, is going to be giving you a little bit of extra capacitive loading of the ends of that coil. Therefore, the frequency will be lowered slightly by the presence of the nylon. Okay. So, in order to measure 6 microhenries, which, if I did the calculation of 1 over 2 pi, now here we go, 2 pi FL, inductive reactance of a 6 microhenry inductor at 60 hertz is going to be such a small number, it's going to require a little more than the circuitry we've been describing up till now to measure that amount of inductive reactance. I misplaced my handheld calculator where I can plug in these numbers real fast, but if I had to make a guess, 6 microhenry at 60 hertz, for all I know, it has an inductive reactance of a quarter of an ohm, something extremely small and not easy to measure, and therefore the circuitry we've been describing for now may not be appropriate. And so a higher frequency circuit, like the grid tip meter or a real signal generator, would allow you to do it. However, let me drop it. For you to measure the inductance of a 6-turn coil in air is the equivalent, Bill, of me saying, I'm going to build a house, I'm going to build it out of these bricks, I want to make sure the bricks are good, so therefore I'm going to take each and every brick and drop it 3 feet over my lawn just to make sure that gravity pulls down on every one of those bricks. You can see how foolish that would be. I mean, once you and I see this red, hard object in your hand, and it doesn't have any great big cracks in it, and the corners are not all rounded off, you know it's a brick. Take a leap of faith and use it to build your house. Well, in the case of a 6-turn coil in air, that's something that's been around since Heinrich Hertz built his first dipole in 1860. If you know the number of millimeters of diameter, let me drop it. If you know the diameter of the coil and the number of turns and the spacing, and you go to the early chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, where there's a beautiful formula in there where you plug in the numbers of diameter, number of turns, and spacing, and it'll tell you microhenries. Take a leap of faith. For you to build with ordinary copper wire, even aluminum wire, with or without enamel covering, to build an air cooler coil that fits that formula, and if the formula tells you that you've done it just right and it calculates to be 6 microhenry, and if you want to make a measurement to find out is it 6 microhenry or 6 nanohenry, maybe, because you put it into a box and you've potted it and you want to know if you've got a shorter turn, that would be a reasonable measurement. However, if you really want to know is it 6 microhenry versus 6.1 microhenry, now you're into laboratory measurements with a known good signal generator and a known good 50 picofarad capacitor across it, and you measure the exact resonant frequency. Or you use your grid dip meter, and the grid dip meter will get you within a 5% error. If you want greater error than that, maybe you use your frequency counter on your grid dip meter, because the biggest error the grid dip meter has is that the dial and the front cover. Let me drop it. As you turn that dial to where it measures 3.0 megahertz, because of the inaccuracy by which that thing is made, by the way you plugged in the coil and so on, and maybe the coil has been dented because it's been sitting in your junk box for a year. When you dial in 3 megahertz, you may be getting really 3.1 megahertz. So unless you put a frequency counter on it, you can't get that degree of accuracy. But it gives you ballpark numbers. It tells you that, yeah, the 6 microhenry inductor that you just wound in air, if you want to do a double good check of it, and you use the grid tip meter, you know it's somewhere between 5.8 and 6.2 microhenry. But an air core coil, to make one out of reasonable wire, with reasonable diameter and reasonable number of turns in air, that doesn't fit that formula. If I had to make a bad air core coil that I can inspect with my eyes, that would be one hell of a challenge. In this case, as I see it, Bill, you can make a leap of faith. AC2IS, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, thanks, Dick. The material, by the way, is tinned copper. But yeah, it was just kind of a I guess a point of curiosity on my part, and I believe the predicted value for that part was 0.1 microhenry, not 6 microhenry. So 6 wines, I think, is supposed to get you 0.1 microhenry. AC2IS.
Out of curiosity, Bill, you're winding this 0.1 microhenry coil. Is that going to be part of one of your Island Labs experiments with helicopters, for instance? I'm kind of curious where this is going to go. Or is this an academic laboratory experiment? AC2IS, K2LIW, wait for the beep.
One of our members over in Island Labs, he's been dealing with transmitter and also some first-person video stuff, and I think he's occasionally had issues of interference between the two. It just sort of made him curious about radios. He actually, I think just 2 weeks ago maybe, got his tech license, and he expressed an interest in building an RF oscillator or a transmitter. So we found a small designed for a small Colpitts, I think, transmitter, FM transmitter, including an electric mic. So I believe he's going to attempt to build this radio. The inductor was one of the components he needed, so Matt last week bought a screw and wound an inductor for him, AC2IS.
You guys are now at an interesting point, as I see it, Bill, and that is, how much do you build, how much do you, I have to put it in, right? Yes, I do. How much you build, how much do you buy? When it comes to a first-person viewing helicopter-like, radio-controlled helicopter situation, there are loads and loads of brand names out there of little transmitters that are good for video transferring of information from the camera on the helicopter back down to the ground, and receivers that you can use on the ground. I mean, you can buy that equipment with a one-day salary at your salary rate, Bill. Whereas if you build it, you're going to invest 2 or 3 weeks of your life in building it, and another couple of weeks debugging it. And now, are you guys that frugal that you want to do it that way, as opposed to, and maybe you're doing it as an educational experiment to learn how to build transmitters and receivers? Those are the choices. The example that I often give on this one, let me drop this. Let's assume that I suddenly got interested in astronomy, and I want to have an 8-inch diameter Newtonian telescope. Nowadays, I can buy that with a couple of days' salary, maybe a week's salary. If I want to grind my own mirror, an 8-inch diameter, good parabolic mirror, it's going to take me a year of my life, a good fraction of a year of my life, in my free time, to grind that mirror. I can probably buy that mirror for $200 or $100, but it's going to take me a year of my life to build it. And now you've got to decide, am I in love with the parabolic grinding process, and I want to do it because it's an art form that I enjoy, go to it. But if I want to look through it as a telescope, and I can buy it with a couple of days' salary, or I can spend a year of my life, you can see the trade-off. So, a very similar situation here. At first I thought that you're building a 0.1 microhenry inductor because it's going to become one of the components of a filter, a bandpass filter. You might have to build a bandpass filter to make sure that all the frequencies coming out of the video transmitter do not jam the receiver that's on board of this radio-controlled aircraft. Let me drop. So there's a whole rigmarole you might have to go through to make sure that these two independent chunks of electronics, the video air-to-ground link versus the radio control up-down link to the helicopter, make sure that those two radio systems are not interfering with each other. Enough frequency separation, enough polarization separation of the transmitting and receiving antennas. Physical separation, I mentioned, the right amount of filtering. I mean, you can tolerate a transmitter and a receiver being very close to each other if you've got extremely good shielding and bandpass filtering. So, to build your own video transmitter and receiver, video transmitter on the craft and video receiver on the ground, as opposed to buying it, you're at an interesting crossroads. Are you trying to learn the art of building and receiving transmitters and receivers? Or do you want to make it work and therefore you write a check and make the problem go away and buy one of the many brands of systems that already exist. AC2IS, K2IW in the TechNet.
This is AC2IS. Maybe I wasn't clear, but this guy just sort of became curious about these things because of his experiences with RC radios and his video transmitter. He's not looking to transmit video or control his device with this radio he's building. The device is intended to transmit audio on a broadcast FM band at a very low power. It's powered from a 9-volt battery. It has a range of maybe several hundred feet. Audio only. AC2IS.
If you haven't already done so, Bill, go to QRZ.com and dial in K3LR, Kilo 3 Lima Romeo. That's Timothy Duffy, who lives in western Pennsylvania. And you go to one of the websites, one of the URLs that he indicates on the bottom of that website, and you start looking at the quadcopter video. It turns out that Timothy owns probably 7 or 8 towers that's on a 2 or 3 acre piece of land, beautiful piece of land in western Pennsylvania, right alongside of Route 80. And these are 100, 150, 180 foot high towers, similar to Rhone 55 Tower. And he's got multiple stacked Yagis on rotatable ring rotators on those towers. 3 or 4 5-element Yagis on 2 meters, and Yagis on 15 meters, 20 meters, 15 meters, and so on. He, as a contest operator, has an operation that's just out of sight. However, some guy with a beautiful quadcopter flew over that site, up and down the sides of the towers, over the towers, and you get this beautiful view of flying over that site. I mean, it's a better than a bird's eye view. This is it's a view that a very stable hummingbird would get, if you know what I mean. The inertial stabilization that was on that helicopter is just out of sight. You get a very non-jitter picture as this thing flies around that property. You go and look at those pictures, and if you guys at Island Labs view that video, you're going to say, wow, I want to do that. As a first-person video viewing aerial vehicle, radio-controlled, quadcopter-like thing, you look at those videos, you guys are going to say, I want to do that. Go to K3 Lima Romeo and look at those videos. Need to fill in that bill. AC2IS, wait for the beep. K2IW in the TechNet.
I'm at the QRZ site right now. I see a bunch of YouTube links, and I will check them out in due time. Thanks for that. AC2IS.
Hey, I'm passing you.
Okay, you're passing me. So, are you telling me you're hearing me very well on the input? Is that what you're saying, Eric? K2EJ? Going from Selden to someplace like Plainview? K2IW, you got it, Eric.
No, it's coming from Glen Oaks, and I'm going to Selden. I'm going to take care of the other half. Because this is what I have time. But forget about it, the next week.
So you do some of your best work on Sunday evening. Fantastic, Eric. And well done. Okay, I'm hearing great improvements, so keep doing it. And I'm hearing you very loud in the input. I can tell you're very close to me. Alrighty, of the guys who signed in, we thought this was going to be a light night. We've only spent 2 hours during the 1 hour portion that was allocated for questions and answers. But from my point of view, we got into some very good material. Now, a person who is a critic of the TechNet will say, hey, you guys have discussed resonant circuits a lot before. You've discussed grid dip meters before. This is a repeat. Really? As you can tell, each individual person who brings that particular subject to our attention has his own individual spin on how he made the measurement, how he interpreted the results. What does it mean? Where does he go from here? Are the results accurate? Are the results repeatable? Are the results reasonable? And so on. I mean, the tech net has existed for 32 years. Have we repeated subjects? Yea, verily. Every single week, some particular subject, if you want to be a critic, you can say, hey, you guys are repeating. But is it really a repeat? Let me drop it. Because we curious amateurs who are building, tinkering, fixing, improving, and so on, our radio circuits, among other things, there's always a slight difference. There's a zillion ways you can approach standing wave ratio. And yeah, we discuss some kind of an antenna almost every single TechNet, but there are 5,000 kinds of antennas, and I'm not kidding. And inside of each one of those 5,000 antennas, there's various variations as to how you do it, what materials you build, how big, how small, did you compact it? Are you doing things to squeeze it down to fit into your particular piece of property? Are you controlling the polarization? Are you building it out of unusual materials and so on? So, do we repeat? Yes, every single TechNet has got to repeat. Is it a real repeat? You've got to be the judge on that one. We're into a real gray zone here. You're about to see, I've had a little bit of a hint this week as to what we're about to get from the mailbag, and you're about to hear some unusual question from a future scientist from my point of view, a guy that's in the process probably of getting his ham license and or getting the right equipment so he can talk to us directly. KC2WGB, end with the mailbag, and do repeat the mailbag address a couple of times, and is it on the QRZ.com? KC2WGB to take it. K2RW TechNet, you got a chance.
KC2WGB, good evening, Dick. And Paul, you're on the net. Yeah, we have some good questions here. Oh, by the way, the website is listed on my QRZ page. It's Juliet Baker 5 Oscar Oscar at AOL.com. And emails that come through there, I will present to the net. We get a few a week, and I sort through them, and we try to collectively put them together and ask a common question that seems to be being asked. So, glad to handle it for you guys. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to my first question. Okay, have a young gentleman here who is playing with touch-tone phones. He wants to know why they use two tones, two distinct tones, when you press one button. Why did they use one tone? What is the purpose of it? Maybe you can give a little rundown on that tone on the touch tone phone stick. KC2WGB, back to you.
I picked up the wrong microphone. I'm down to my last 5 radios here. I suspect there's a lot of history to this one. Way back in the dark ages of ITT and Ma Bell and Bell Laboratories and the invention of high-performance wired telephone circuits. In the very early days, when you plugged money into your payphone, you'll notice that you heard some crazy beeps in the background, or in the process of making a long-distance phone call, you heard beep, boop, 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 beep. You wondered what in the world was that. And that was the system, not too different from our local repeaters, where we've got a PL tone. In other words, by various tones being transmitted through the audio circuit, various other pieces of electronics in other towns, in other states, connected to that audio circuit, said, hey, that tone is addressing me, therefore I'm supposed to enable this particular repeater function, so that line from New York City to Ohio now gets connected to the line that goes to Wisconsin to complete the rest of this long-distance phone call. So sending tones down an audio circuit in order to do control and measurement functions is something that's been around probably since 1900 or a little bit after that, when wired telephones started becoming popular. Let me drop. A little bit similar to what Europe has, particularly in London, they've got a number of repeaters that are called whistle-up repeater. If the repeater has been sitting idle for a long time, and you don't want some stray signal to turn on the repeater, they set it up in such a way that there's got to be a burst of, I think it's 1750 hertz, something like that is the frequency, that has to come out of a transmitter that goes into the receiver of that repeater in order to turn the repeater on. And we've got PL tones that we use for this repeater, and they're usually one
like we hit